Welcome to CurryCast, the April 6th episode of the 2007 Risk and Prevention Speaker Series. This CurryCast series is a product of the Curry School of Education, University of Virginia. Today's speakers are Dr. Helen Lutt and Paul Richardson, Faculty of Education, Monash University, Australia. Their talk today is entitled Motivations, Engagement, and Aspirations, Choosing Teaching as a Career.
I'm going to introduce our speakers today. Helen Watt has previously held positions at University of Virginia. Oops, sorry about that.
She never told me.
This is at University of Michigan, University of Western Sydney, University of Sydney, and Macquarie University. Did I get that right? Close? Okay. And she's been interested in motivation, mathematics education, gendered educational and occupational choice, and motivations for teaching and teacher self-efficacy. So this is an area that's close to our heart. She's received awards in Australia and the United States and has attracted external funding and has published in many international journals. And Paul Richardson returned to Monash in July from University of Michigan, where he worked as a research scientist on an NICHD-funded study, Social and Cultural Influences on Adolescent Literacy, Motivation, and Development. And his research focuses on adolescent identity development, teaching and learning in higher education, motivations for teaching, and teacher self-efficacy. He's published in Australian and international journals as well. So please join me in welcoming Helen and Paul Richardson. The name of their talk is Motivations, Engagement, and Aspirations, Choosing Teaching as a Career.
I'm going to be first, but we're going to tag team this as pretty much we do in most things. I'll give you a chance to get used to my accent. I'm told that it's easier for people who are down south rather than people who are up north. So we do tend to have a slight drawl, I'm told. Okay, so we have a program of research which we're going to go through today. We began this program of research with phase one, which is probably a good place to start. And we were looking initially at motivations, why people choose teaching as a career. I'm not going to tell you why we started with all this, but that was our first phase. Then we decided that we really wanted to know what happened after that. So we then began to design phase two. When we looked at phase one, the measures for phase one that were out there in the literature, it sounds arrogant to say it, but we're very unhappy with. And we just thought, well, all right, we can do better than this. So we spent a couple of years of our life designing measures for phase one. Then we looked at the measures for phase two on self-efficacy and thought, So we spent lots of time working on that. So we have new measures for phase one, we have new measures for phase two, and you'll not be surprised that we're also thinking that phase three needs new measures as well. Phase two, I just should explain, choice of teaching at the beginning of the teacher education program, right at the beginning, we wanted to get it as early as we possibly could. So in Australia we have students who undertake teacher education programs may take 4 years, or they may take 1 year, depending on whether they already have a degree. So if they have a degree, they take 1 year. It's like an end-on program. And so we have students who are at different points in time. This is a nightmare if you have a large-scale study, because we have some people who completed within a year and some people who take 4 years. It's like waiting for a baby to grow up or something, I think. So we're looking at the second part is how confident are teacher education candidates across the spectrum, and we're looking at that as they leave the teacher education program, no matter when it happens. So we take them at the beginning and right at the end, and then we thought we really want to follow this same group of people that we've been looking at into the field. We want to see what happens to them and to test out some of the anecdotal stuff that's out there about what happens to teachers' efficacy and a whole range of other matters. So phase three is about environment, personal environment, fit perhaps, stress, anxiety, and all those issues. Now, this is the model. The reason I'm putting it up is that you probably can't read it from that point, but it's just to show that we actually have a model in some way. And you can get access to this model by reading the papers, in a sense. So phase one is here. Oh, I should use this. Phase one is here. Phase two is here. Phase three is here. All right. And you can see that this is a progressive thing that goes right across, and I'm not going to spend lots of time talking about that. Why factors influencing teaching choice? Because we had to have something that we could name our scale. Believe it or not, it took us a long time to come up with FIT, and now people think we're doing stuff with physical education. But we have a title we're happy with, we're comfortable with. You will have noticed that we also have the set. That's Helen's design. She spent a lot of sleepless nights thinking about the self-efficacy for teaching scale, which is phase two. So the fit and the set. Key questions, why do we do this in the first place? Probably because we're slightly insane, but the other reason is that there were a whole bunch of questions that have been driving issues in Australia. Not least of all, we have a major teacher shortage in some areas. State departments of education, like in all sorts of places, will give you very little data that's reliable. But we do know from the calls we get from principals that there are really hard to staff areas, there are really hard to staff regions, hard to staff districts, and there are areas where, if you look at the OECD documents, Australia is exactly parallel with those. We have problems in math, science, technology, ICT, and languages. And we have shortages in all of those. We have a critical shortage of physics teachers, for instance, to the point where you can get quite a lot of money to support your studentship, etc., if you want to be a physics teacher. So we have major shortages in certain areas of Australia. We also have major shortages increasingly around the world, and we can probably talk about that later on. There are certainly shortages here in the United States, as I'm sure you're aware of. One of the things we were trying to do was also look at the teacher education literature, and one of the things we were very unhappy about was that no one had actually thought of actually taking the motivational literature that exists in terms of occupational literature and also in motivational models and trying to look at those and map them onto the teacher education literature that was out there. So that was one of the things we wanted to do, or we decided to do. And we wanted to look at this in terms of long-term. So it was a longitudinal project. Any of you who work in longitudinal projects, you realise that there are lots of questions you can ask and answer to some degree that you can't answer in one-off things. So the timeliness of it and to contextualise motivations was the issue that was first phase. All right. Helen has done a lot of work with Jack Eccles Jack Eccles' data sets. I've been working on those data sets as well. But we also wanted to draw on the model that Jackie had developed for expectancy value model, because we thought it mapped very nicely to a lot of what we were doing in terms of teacher ed. And it's certainly been fruitfully applied to other areas outside just choice of mathematics in school. And it certainly we thought it was useful to apply to teaching as a career. And we started mapping this onto the task related values and task demand and ability beliefs, etc., that we thought would map nicely. And then the more distal influences of socialisation, perceptions, etc. This is the theoretical model we came up with. And I think I'm going to let Helen take that from here, right? No, I haven't.
Does it need a little thing on it to record?
Oh, it helps.
Okay.
You're fine.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay. So I imagine some of you might be quite familiar with the expectancy value framework anyway, but it's a very comprehensive model, and basically the three most proximal sets of predictors to choices to participate in certain types of activities are related to the self, beliefs about your own abilities and skills, beliefs about the task, so how difficult and demanding it is and how much effort it will require you to put in, and your own values. And there's different types of values. Intrinsic values are akin to interest and liking and enjoyment. Utility values are akin to your perceptions about how useful the object is. And subjective attainment value is a value that refers to your own individual life goals. So things that for you are personally important to your sense of identity and development. So we thought, well, how does this map to the context of teaching as a career choice? Because this model was developed in the domain of senior high mathematics. So we had to do a bit of sort of, well, translation, I guess is the right word, to this different context. So we engaged in this mapping exercise where we looked at a lot of the factors that have been identified in the teacher education literature as influencing people's choices of a teaching career, and we sort of mapped them to the self, task and value main sets of factors in the expectancy value model. And here's what we came up with. First, we split the task features into demand and return. And this was because in the Australian context, we've had a number of inquiries into the teaching profession and into teacher education, and there's been a lot of publicity and attention to the low social status and the low salary of teaching. So we particularly wanted to get a handle on how prospective teachers viewed these possible rewards or lack thereof. So we have the task return and we have the task demand. And for everything here, we designed multiple item indicators in terms of Likert type rating scales, where respondents rate on a scale from 1 to 7. There's a preface at the top of the page that says, I chose to become a teacher because. And then there's a series of propositions, and they rate from 1, not at all important, up to 7, extremely important. So for each of these factors here, there are multiple item indicators, and then we think that the first order factors also can be grouped under higher order factors in this way. All right, for the self factors, we developed items to tap self-perceived teaching abilities. For the values, when there's nothing under the capitals, it means that we just thought there was a first order factor there. We don't have component first order factors nested within higher order factors. So items about liking and enjoyment of teaching activity. For subjective attainment value, we actually relabeled this. We thought it was a sort of non-intuitive label. We actually refer to this now as personal utility value, which just, you know, clearly splits the objective perceived utility and the personal life goals. So here we thought, well, job security, time for family, job transferability, the idea of a portable job that will let you choose where you wish to live, and in the context of Australia, opportunities for travel and overseas travel, which seems to be something that comes up again and again with Australian prospective teachers. And bludging is an Australian... So the only other Australian in the room knows exactly what I'm talking about. But this is an Australian colloquialism, and we weren't trying to be cute. We just really couldn't think of a parallel word that really got at what we were after. So bludging refers to getting by with the least amount of effort exertion. So here we developed items, for instance, to do with the length of the vacation time and the length of the working day. Okay, so we thought, and this is something that gets press, right, in the media, that people are choosing teaching because they want a cruisy job. All right, so we wanted to particularly look at that. Okay, then utility value, just to make it really clear, the distinction between the personal utility value and the utility value, we've called this social utility value, and also because we thought, well, in the context of teaching, what does utility mean, a perception of an objective utility? Well, it's probably in terms of the social purposes of teaching. And so the factors in here are to shape the future of children or adolescents, to enhance social equity, make a social contribution, and to work with children or adolescents. And then we also thought we want to get this idea of teaching as a fallback career. So people who have defaulted into teaching rather than actively choosing it. And there are items in there such as I was not accepted into my first choice degree, or I was unsure what else to do. All right, so that's our self-task and values. And then we also had factors to do with social dissuasion and social persuasion. We wanted to get at them separately. And also positive prior teaching and learning experiences, such as having experienced good teachers at school. Now the outcome, so Paul's already mentioned that our sample were pre-service teachers, so actually there's no outcome in a sense. They've already all self-selected into teaching. This is a problem, but Paul, in our future directions, will talk about a parallel study that we have of people who have not yet self-selected into teaching to get at this... I always confuse multifinality and endo... whatever it is. Equifinality. So what's the problem here?
Multifinality is when you have many endings, one starting point, and equifinality is one ending, many starting points.
Okay, so the equifinality problem... Or maybe it's both. Anyway, the problem that people could have shared motivational profiles, but not just going to teaching. So there may be other cognate careers, and we would hypothesise that they might be other helping professions, such as social work and medicine, perhaps, we'll find out, that people with these shared motivational profiles might be likely to go into. So we'll be able to get a, whatever that is.
Multifinality.
Thank you. Okay. Oh, but we did develop a sort of proxy outcome measure there, satisfaction with the choice of teaching as a career. So there's items there about, you know, I'm highly satisfied with my choice of teaching, I'm very happy to have chosen a teaching career, etc. And we're able to look at changes in that as a sort of proxy outcome. Okay, so I won't spend much time actually on the validation, I don't think. Except to say that it worked very well. No. okay. So this was with... we did this with two cohorts of Australian pre-service teachers. And in the first group... And they're both at universities in Sydney. So in the first group, you can see that we've got 298 plus 190, 488, I think. And our response rates are very high. And this is important, because it means that we can have more confidence that we're really representing the populations that we're studying here. Okay. And we used the first sample to do a lot of the exploratory work. But then, because we didn't want to over-capitalise on doing confirmatory work on the sample on which we'd done the exploratory work, naughty, naughty, so we had an independent sample to do the confirmatory work. Okay, so this was self-report surveys, which were halfway through their first academic year, which for some people is halfway through their entire teaching qualification, if they're doing the 1 year, like a master's of teaching, I think you call it here. But then for the people who are doing the bachelor degree, and so they don't already have a prior degree, this is in the first year of their 4 years. And we administered the surveys, which took about 20 minutes for everyone to complete. Okay, so we did exploratory factor analyses followed by measures of Cronbach alpha reliabilities in our undergraduate bachelor sample of the first university, and then we applied the exploratory factor analysis applying the same number of items to our master sample in the first university to see if we got the same factor solution. So this was all very unconstrained, just to see if it was coming out as we had theorised. And then we did a confirmatory factor analysis across the combined two subsets of our first university. And then we did a nested confirmatory factor analysis, which looked at the items going to their first order factors as well as the first order factors going to their higher order factors still in our first university. Then in the second university, we just did the confirmatory work. So we looked at the nested confirmatory factor analysis there. Okay, so here's our empirically validated theoretical model, and what's different? Okay, so first of all, bludging disappeared. But this is actually, I think we actually need to write a paper just about this one point. This is very interesting. The bludging was empirically indistinguishable from time for family. Isn't that neat? So that appears to imply that the people who endorse choosing a teaching career for reasons such as the length of the vacation time and the length of the working day are not choosing teaching out of laziness or a desire to bludge, but for important quality of life reasons. And that's really important. Okay, so that's the first thing. Also, teacher morale disappeared from from task return, and actually this was indistinguishable from social status. But we retained the label social status because we thought it still reflected the combination of the teacher morale items and the social status items. Anything else, Paul? Oh, and here, these are now no longer represented as first-order factors under a higher-order factor. We found that social dissuasion, social persuasion, and positive prior teaching and learning experiences were not that highly interrelated, and so they need to be considered separately, not under an overarching construct. Okay, so the model worked very well. Oh, these are just the alphas. Okay. This is something we need to think a bit further about. The higher order task demand factor at our second university didn't really stand up. So these are perceptions of teaching as a highly expert career and perceptions of teaching as a highly demanding career, which we thought would go together. We designed them to be part of our higher order task demand construct, which was the case in our first university but not in the second one, and we just need to think a bit more about that. And we've got lots more samples now, so it's going to be interesting to see how the factors move about. Okay. So the expectancy value framework did appear to provide a useful umbrella for us to look at the factors influencing the choice of teaching. Our theoretical framework was empirically validated, and Paul's now... So the findings that we would like to share with you today are about the motivations for choosing teaching, which are important, and not just in our Australian sample, but Paul's going to share with you some of our international comparisons there across Australia, the United States, Germany and Norway. And we've been collecting other countries since then, but that's all that we have ready to share with you at the moment. And then we'd like to share with you the longitudinal relationships between entry motivations and exit professional commitment and engagement and aspirations. Okay, so just a point which is not a trivial point before Paul shares the international comparisons is that we've actually been able to establish strong factorial invariance of our motivation scale, our fit choice scale, across those four countries, Australia, United States, Germany and Norway. So what this means, and too often internationally comparative research proceeds with people using one scale and saying, you know, well, we can compare these things because we've used the one scale, without checking whether the scale is in fact functioning in a similar manner across the different contexts. So to put it another way, checking whether the constructs are qualitatively comparable before engaging in quantitative comparisons of means across contexts. So we're very excited about that. And so Paul will share with you the comparisons and the motivations.
Should be seamless, you know. I'm never going on the stage.
Yes, one of the things that we have discovered that now we have a scale that works, that is available. As a little advertisement, I should say that we have the scale coming out in the Journal of Experimental Education, and they said it would be out yesterday. So our timing is quite good. It's been... we haven't received it yet, and I was anxious to be able to say something about it, but we haven't received it. It's coming out in that journal, and you'll be able to read the validation of it there. One of the things we have found, because we now have a validated scale, lots of people are interested in it, which I guess that's a good point. So we've now collected data in a number of places, and we just want to report, as Helen was saying, on some of the data we collected using our scale, our fit choice scale, with samples in Norway, and I should say it was done in Norway in English, but at the Max Planck Institute in Berlin, they translated the scale into German, and we also have now colleagues in various places. So the fit choice scale is now being done in China and in Taiwan, in Brunei and Darussalam, and where else have we got it now? It's also been done in Britain and a couple of other places. So we're actually quite looking forward to having this data across various locations. But as Helen said, we now also know that looking at it across, even where it's been translated with the German sample, that the scale functions pretty much as we hoped it would in different contexts. So here are some interesting bars. These are, if we look at this one here, for instance, to begin with, this time for family, I think it's interesting that there's really no significant difference across these. And the one thing we, the one thing that's actually interesting from your point of view is Australia is blue, the US is black, Germany is red, and Norway is green. You'll notice that right across, and if you actually follow the line, all right, which is more interesting than anything else much, if you follow the line, the USA is highest on everything. You're a very enthusiastic lot. But it's very interesting. If you actually follow the line, the German and the Norwegians are pretty similar. All right? So I mean, if you look at this one here, if you look at social equity and think about the context of Norway, where it's a highly egalitarian country, a very small country as well, it is interesting that they're actually quite a lot lower on here and on Shape the Future. So there's a sense in which the Norwegians are actually lower, although, I mean, obviously the scale's functioning quite nicely. They're also lower on work with children and adolescents and on making a social contribution. And we've actually sort of talked about this with our German colleagues, and we suspect that it may be something to do with the actual way in which Norwegian teachers actually look upon their social role, in a sense, and that they're slightly lower simply because they don't necessarily see that in an egalitarian society that they need to make such a huge difference, in a sense. At least that's what we're theorising at the moment. Anything else I should say about them?
Well, just that they're more similar than they're different.
Yeah. If you follow the bars are going all in the same direction. There's nothing that really stands out. When this first came out and we looked at it, it was like, what do we say about this? Because it looks like it's just all the same. But that in itself is very interesting. The one that interests me as well is that social dissuasion is quite low in this social influences. It's certainly below the midpoint. And in the press in Australia, whether students are just not picking it up, but in the press in Australia, there's almost like a campaign to dissuade people from going into teaching. It's made to be one of the least attractive jobs in some ways. Certainly least attractive professions. It would be worrying if you had a whole bunch of people who were, I mean, even the Norwegians are way above the midpoint, okay? But it would be worrying if you had a whole bunch of people going into teaching who didn't want to work with children. So, you know, I mean, you know. I think the other one that's very, very interesting, and this is across the samples, we thought it was just in Australia, perceived ability, people's perception that they have an ability and they have an understanding this is right at the beginning of their teacher education program, that they already have an idea that they've got the ability to be a teacher and they've got experiences of being a teacher. I think it's very interesting as well. So if you look at the advertising campaigns, which I'll talk about in a bit, but a lot of advertising campaigns around the world don't even acknowledge that, in a sense. They don't pick up that whole idea of a perceived ability. I was just talking about perceived ability. As predicted in the expectancy value model, values and personal and social values are very important. Perceived ability, I think, was something we didn't really expect in one sense to be as important as it is. But it certainly provides, we would argue, a very useful theoretical model for looking at the way in which the results support values and ability perceptions as major predictors. And social influence is relatively unimportant in one sense. I mean, certainly lower than we would expect. Additional important predictors are prior teaching and learning experiences. it's interesting that across the samples that people have said that they've had not any good teachers, or they may have had bad teachers, but they've had prior positive teaching and learning experiences with students in various contexts. So we're seeing increasingly, I was reading something the other day, an article that somebody had written about importance of things like scouting bodies or teaching swimming or informal outside school activities that are actually people engage in. I guess in this country, having experience in sort of homework groups or homework programs may be a way in which people get experience. But certainly working with kids and adolescents in various contexts, not in classrooms, providing a framework for teaching and learning that they have experience of. Differences in perceptions. Am I doing this one? I think I am. Differences in perceptions. Well, it's interesting that if you look at it in terms of, we've only got Australia, US and Germany here, and the usual colours. It's perceived to be an expert, certainly above the midpoint, and looking at what's above the midpoint is interesting. It's not a surprise. This is lower, except in Germany, where you have a comparison, the salaries are actually quite a bit high. If you look at the OECD figures, Germany, Switzerland come out as very high in terms of teacher salaries, and as a comparison across other professions, the salaries are actually quite good. Status, well, interesting, isn't it? Salary is high. Status is perceived to be low by comparison with the other two. In fact, even lower. And our students in Australia are quite able to distinguish between knowing that it's going to be a poor salary, and this is right at the beginning. They know it's going to be a poor salary, but they're still going to go into it anyway. One of the things that accounts, we think, although we want to soften this slightly after Helen spent some time in Germany in the last couple of weeks, the PISA data that came out in Germany had a huge impact. There was a massive campaign by politicians. The then Chancellor of Germany was quite blunt in the newspaper, saying that teachers were doing a very poor job, that Germany was failing in the PISA. The PISA is the international data that comes out on students, and that the teachers were doing a very bad job, and that we were overpaying them, and that there was a whole campaign that went on. And we think that maybe this accounts for some degree, although you had some other... Do you want to say something about the softening that?
The couple of times that I talked about this in Germany, you know, people said, well, the status wasn't good before this. So I think that actually the media publicity about the PISA... They call it the PISA shock. We didn't come up with the PISA shock. I think this just sort of highlighted and brought more to public consciousness the low status of the teaching profession. But it makes a very important point, which is that status is not all about salary.
Mm. Well, there's a there's a very important campaign going on at the moment by our federal minister. We had a federal system and a state system, somewhat like the United States. And we have the federal minister is now saying that she wants to ensure that teacher status goes up, because we're going to pay them differentially. So we're going to pay the best teachers. How they work that out will be interesting to see. The most effective teachers, these words get used interchangeably, the best, the most effective and the most successful teachers, will pay them more money, and that'll actually keep them in the profession. We have obviously a problem of retaining people as well as attracting people in. I think it's very interesting that regardless of which country, people are very satisfied with their choice of the career. So even though they know the status is lower, they know that salary is quite low in most cases, but they also know it's going to be a difficult career, or it's a difficult job, and it requires a fairly high level of expertise. Deterrence, well, high demand, low return, moderate experiences of social dissuasion. I mean, we don't see in our data across the countries that people are being heavily persuaded not to go into teaching. There was a period in the state where we're from, in Victoria, where the state government went on a campaign, a very conservative, one might even say right-wing government, went on a campaign of getting rid of 10,000 teachers out of the system. They wanted to, you know, to get them, so they just simply increased class sizes and began redundancy packages for people. And teaching wasn't a very attractive proposition for a lot of students at that point in time. A lot of people coming out of schools were being dissuaded by their teachers and their parents from going to teaching. That's about 15 years ago, and that shock has now gone through, and we're now seeing very high entrance requirements into teacher education programs, particularly our university, where the entrance is higher than a number of other professions. Recruitment campaigns, well, these are some of the implications. Some of the implications we think are that there's too much emphasis on teachers making a social contribution. One of the things we were interested in that paralleled a lot of the findings that we have is that the TTA in England, in Britain, was running a campaign about use your head and come into teaching. They were trying to get teaching to be a much more intellectually challenging career, or to be perceived as being intellectually challenging. And it seemed to us that that would be one of the things that we would be arguing out of the data that we've got on motivations. And there are important motivations, we think, that just don't get highlighted. Perceived ability, for instance, is something that doesn't get highlighted very much. And we think, and Helen will probably talk about this as well, more targeted recruitment based on typologies of different sorts of people. There's been an assumption in our country that you can make a comment about teachers and teacher education and that people coming into teaching are all the same. We haven't actually thought about different groups and different typologies of people coming into teaching. Do you want to take this? Okay, so phase two, we've done phase one, that's phase one over. Now you have to go to phase two, different mindset, and Helen's going to talk about the development of that.
This is almost our last challenge, and Paul will wrap up with future directions at the end.
Finishing rounds.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Actually, I wasn't going to talk about the typologies stuff.
Okay.
But it's one of the readings, actually, that's on the website. Because out of the measures that I'm going to talk about now, which is on the conclusion of people's teaching qualification, we actually we used a cluster analysis to look at whether we could identify different types in terms of their career engagement and professional development aspirations. And we could. We identified three types that are quite interesting. The first we call the highly engaged persisters, which accounted for almost half the sample, and they were high on everything: planned effort, planned persistence, professional development, high aspirations, high leadership aspirations, and they're the four that we clustered them on. The second group that we called the highly engaged switchers were high on everything except for planned persistence, and this was slightly over a quarter of the sample, and that group. The first group increased in their satisfaction with choice through their teacher education, which might suggest that they got sort of increasingly turned on and perceived a good fit to their skills and values and the characteristics of a teaching career. The highly engaged switchers maintained stable satisfaction, which suggests that they weren't getting turned off, and this is before they've started teaching. So it's at the conclusion of their teaching studies, which suggests that we need to think about what individuals are bringing with them in terms of their motivations in understanding why people might leave the profession. So there's been a sort of over-attribution to early professional experiences as the cause of attrition. But actually this highly engaged switchers group, which was more than a quarter of the sample, 27% from memory, they were very planful about what they wanted to do next and why and when they would do it, and it wasn't because of declining satisfaction. And we also collected a bunch of open-ended data on this survey, and Paul is the qualitative arm of the project. And themes came through there such as restless spirits, stepping stoners, very planfully using a teaching qualification as a means to move on to education careers more broadly, etc. So that was a very interesting group that we need to be aware of in thinking about succession planning. And the third cluster we called the lower engaged assisters, and that was the sort of bad story. So they were low on everything, and their satisfaction had gone down. And this might be the group that we might want to think about interventions with, because looking at their open-ended responses about why their satisfaction went down, which mentioned mostly poor practicum experiences, well, maybe we can structure that better. And also realisations of the lack of primarily administration support in schools. All right, maybe teacher education can't do too much about that. That would be a broader sort of policy initiative. But these might provide us with levers for change in retaining a quarter of prospective teachers in the profession for longer. Okay, so they were our professional engagement and career development aspiration factors, and we re-administered the satisfaction with choice measure at time two. Again, they're 7-point scales. So we only are sharing with you the data here from the people who did the one-year teaching degree, because we only collected the time two data from the bachelor degree people at the end of last year, so it's just not ready yet. And so to make it look fuller, I've done different bars for each university. Because, yeah. Okay, so here we have three Australian universities in the black, blue and red, and one American university in the green. We have another one, but it wasn't ready at the time. Okay, so what you can see basically is that sample-wide, people are planning to be effortful, to persist, a bit lower, to engage in professional development, a bit lower on leadership aspirations, and they're still very high in their satisfaction with the choice of a teaching career. All right, most interestingly, what are the relationships between entry motivations and these types of outcomes? Oh, but wait. okay. Before we get there, we also had a question where we asked people to check one of three boxes, whether, because planned persistence on a 1 to 7 scale from not at all to extremely, I mean, how do we get a handle on that in real time? So we asked them to check a box to say whether they plan to teach for their whole career, that's the black, to teach in the short term and then have a different profession, that's the blue, and if they checked that, we asked them what and when and why. Or red, do not want a teaching career at all, and then we ask them why and what are you going to do and so on. So reassuringly, maybe, we don't have many red people, but we've got quite a lot of blue people who are planning to teach in the short term and then do something else. I won't talk more about that because I already talked about the typologies, which sort of gets at that. Okay, the relationship between the time one and the time two stuff. So these are just plain old Pearson correlations. And across the top are the time two variables, and down the side are the time one variables. And at the very bottom and last column is the satisfaction with choice, which was the only variable at the two time points. So you can see that that remains fairly stable, 0.58, across their degree. And also, satisfaction at time one correlates moderately with all of these other longitudinal outcomes, which gives some support for researchers who are doing one time point type data to use this satisfaction with choice sort of proxy outcome with people that have already self-selected into teaching as an outcome variable. Okay, so I've ruled off the intrinsic values, the personal values, the social values, ability beliefs, positive prior teaching and learning, and choosing teaching as a fallback career. So intrinsic values relate positively to the whole set of longitudinal outcomes. And anything that wasn't significant, just so there was less clutter here, I haven't put the number. The personal utility values relate negatively to planned persistence and to time two satisfaction with choice. Now, this was interesting because Paul and I got a bit sort of offended reading in the teacher education literature back when we were designing our time one measure, people talking about these types of personal values as being negative motivations for choosing teaching. And we thought, well, how do they know that? You know, but it appears that it does. They do indeed exhibit negative correlations with the outcomes. Whereas people choosing teaching for social utility reasons, these relate positively. Ability beliefs relate positively. Positive prior teaching and learning experiences, where there are relationships, are positive. Not at all surprisingly, choosing teaching as a fallback career relates negatively. And the satisfaction with choice. I hope I also have a chart for the perceptions, do I? Or not? No?
No.
Oh. Okay, so we were very interested. Remember I was talking about the higher order factor for task demand didn't stand up so well? The reliability was only 0.44 in one of our Australian samples, whereas it was satisfactory in the other one. We actually found differential relationships between those two task demand factors and some of these outcomes. We found that the expert career perceptions related positively, whereas task demand just had no relationships at all. And guess what? The task return factors had no relationships at all. So perceiving teaching as having a good salary and good status had no relationship with these types of outcomes. The difficulty, demand stuff, that we thought would have negative relationships had none, but the expert career had positive relationships, which ties back to what Paul was saying about people wanting to choose a cognitively challenging, you know, and stimulating career. So maybe expert career is not a negative. It's not tapping into task demand. It's something different. Okay, and that's the end of me. I'll hand back to Paul.
Do you
want to
do this?
I don't mind.
You do it.
Okay, all right. So it's a longitudinal program of research. Some of it's complete and some of it's still in progress. We're really looking forward to our discussions with you today in terms of talking about when the teachers are out there. And I know that a lot of your work is focused on teachers who are already out there. So we're finalising our instrumentation for our mass survey at the end of this year, where we're looking at all the things that were in that model at the beginning. So a repeat of the phase two commitment, career engagement, also our efficacy set scale, and a bunch of school environment, class environment things, and stress and anxiety and mental health is our focus there. We want to continue to look at this idea of types of people choosing teaching. One of the main interests that Paul came into our collaboration with is the career change people who have switched out of other careers versus people who choose teaching as their first career. Something, an interest I came into this with is gendered motivations, and particularly looking at males who go into early childhood and primary elementary settings. Also, the project that I mentioned earlier, we're looking at why people don't choose teaching. How we're doing that is following, was it Kiriakou? Who looked at, he got a general sample of people through, and this was clever, we were thinking, how do you get a general sample? But he got people at residential colleges on university campuses, and so we're following in his footsteps. We thought that was very clever. And as well as collecting a bunch of information about ideal career characteristics, we're also collecting information about perceptions of the teaching profession and people's views about whether they would choose teaching as a career. So we can look at the different groups of people in terms of whether they would choose teaching, and contrast their ideal career characteristics and look at the extent to which they perceive a teaching career would fulfil them. So that will be neat. We want to continue to contrast motivations across cultural contexts because different particularities of the different settings let us highlight things that we couldn't otherwise look at. So, for example, all the talk in Australia about we just need to pay teachers more to increase the status. Well, the German situation shows us that that's not the case. Status is about more than salary. We're excited to see the Chinese data and Taiwanese data soon, where the status of teachers is good. So, you know, it's going to be very interesting to look at these salient different cultural dimensions and how they play out. So it appears from the comparative data Paul shared that motivations are more or less similar across the different settings, but that perceptions are quite shaped by the different settings. So that will be interesting to continue to explore. The self-efficacies we haven't reported on today, but it'll be interesting to see how efficacy changes from the end of teacher education through into early career experiences, and obviously to look at who stays and who goes. And I think that's pretty much it. And we have a website, which is not there, but it's on the back of Paul's business card. And, oh, it is here? Oh, okay. We have a website where we're putting up everything as we complete it. Yes. And as I mentioned, we're looking forward to actually getting a lot of feedback from you all today, and hoping that this visit might actually lay the base for some sort of continuing association. Thank you.
From a lot of alumni, I'm part of the career services office here, and that a lot of times it's either administrators driving them crazy or parents, and the lack thereof of a parental involvement. And that's where I would think parental involvement could vary in different countries.
Yeah.
And it could be an interesting factor for retention.
Yeah, interesting. We have it as one of our efficacy factors, and why we weren't satisfied with the existing efficacy measures is because they're very focused on within classroom instruction. Mm-hmm. And we thought, well, actually the teacher's role is far more broad and multidimensional than that. And so we've looked at, you know, within classroom as well as with community and parents. So we've got a self-efficacy for being able to communicate with parents. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't let us get at the demand aspect that you've mentioned. Although, has it come up in the interview?
Mm. The thing we haven't reported on today is we're running a parallel interviewing a lot of the people have been out for some time. So we've done 50-odd interviews with the U of N sample and the EMU sample we've got in, you know, following their graduation. And a lot of them talk about the school context, I mean, administrative problems, particularly the people who've left teaching. But also, we asked them directly about, you know, were they prepared for dealing with parents and dealing with the wider issues. Some yes, some no, but I suspect we may find that, the ones that have mentioned it, it's been a factor, certainly. Highly demanding parents and highly, highly demanding parents and not having really strategies for dealing with it. But it depends on the school context too, I think, whether teachers are able to deal with this in a way.
High demanding, because I've worked with students going toward high demanding schools, whether it's private independent schools or some of the private public schools, whatever some people call it. But also, a big thing I've heard is that when parents aren't at all involved, and that it's just the teacher feeling like the teacher has to be the parent, the counselor, that they take on so many roles, and that ties into demand, and how that demand can just get to be too much because the teacher feels all alone, especially if they don't have administration support.
There was a guy I interviewed in Michigan who basically said, which is a lovely phrase, that I didn't sign up for this. Yeah. I mean, it's all the other demands. Because we actually asked them in the interviews about were they actually prepared and did they expect it to be as difficult as it was. Many of them said that they really had no idea, that they just didn't realise it was just going to be. But again, it depends on where they are. If you're in downtown Detroit, it's a pretty difficult area. And if they're I interviewed some people in some of the charter schools where they had no textbooks, the equipment wasn't there. These were people who changed careers. So they were people had paid $25,000 to do a teacher education program at U of M, and they were going back to be engineers. You know, I can't deal with this. It's just like I'm out of here. And they were people who had found it very difficult to get a job as well. Like, that's the other aspect of that. So they eventually got a job in these charter schools that were grossly under-resourced. And some of the charter schools were obviously very good, but others were really, really terrible. Just being used as a sort of a... I guess I better be careful, because I could be... Is this being recorded?
You can cut that out.
Yeah.
I
Maybe I'm misreading, but how far into their teaching career are you interviewing? Are you waiting until they leave? I mean, and your longitudinal study, are they having 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years teaching before they get interviewed by you?
Some of the ones that we've been interviewing have been in their first year mostly, haven't they? In second year.
1 and 4, depending on if they did the 4-year qualification or the 1-year qualification. And we would have liked to have had everyone in 1, but we can live with the cross-section of 1 and 4. It's because we were living in the United States at the time.
Well, I trained as a teacher from age 38 to age 40. I was a student teacher at 40. And then I entered an elementary school position with a principal I knew for whom we had been active in PTA classrooms when our children were in that school. And I came back to my professors after a year, and I said, why didn't you tell us the first year was hell? And they said, it's like that for everybody, but if we told you that, nobody would go into So I'm thinking there may be a difference, because my job satisfaction, you know, once I realized, and I've been transferred from a South Carolina district up for 6 years to work for the Department of Defense in overseas positions, and that put me in a lot of new places every few years. And so I learned, you know, it's the orientation, the initiation. You can survive the first year of your material for the second, you know. But I think you might want to see, because the crunch between the university setting and what actually happens, whether it's parent involvement or how the principal wants the attendance taken, and then all these things have to happen in the first 2 seconds of school, you know, those kind of things.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think there's no doubt we're going to find different types of responses depending on the timing that they've been out. What I think is actually confounding a lot of these issues, certainly in our country, is that getting a job is becoming, and this is the same in Michigan that we can find or see, getting a job is a huge problem. I mean, a lot of the teachers that we're seeing are itinerant almost. They're trying to survive on contract teaching positions for short terms, replacement positions. Across the OECD countries, there's a large report on teaching matters suggests exactly the same pattern is now. It's a change in the way in which the workplace almost is being developed. We're seeing major structural changes in the nature of work in Australia. Contract work is now... there's no security, no job security. So it's having a major impact on teaching, because people have a job. Principals are trying to save money, so they give someone a replacement for a term. But, I mean, you can't run a career on a series of 5, 6, 7 contracts. And I've interviewed people, and some of the people who are working for us, where they just say, you know, I just can't survive on this. I just can't. Like, if you're 28 or 30 or something, and you try to get married and have a family, and all you can get is an insecure one semester contract. That's not very attractive. So I think that's a major structural problem within the profession at the moment as well.
Yeah. One thing I wasn't sure if it fell under your questions about the fallback option is taking a look at what the job market looks like. So I know, especially within certain disciplines, when you have a very good job market versus poor job market, you're going to have differences in how many people decide they might want to go to teaching. I don't know if that fell under that kind of
We don't have anything which can exactly tap that, no. Except, I guess we do have, for the people who switched from a previous career, we have what they were doing, how satisfied they were with it, and why they left it. So we could sort of indirectly get at that. We're working on a paper at the moment looking at STEM teachers, science, maths, we don't have engineering, and information technology. And guess what? Their motivational profiles look just like everyone else's. But we also want to try and get some information on quality through trying to dig up maybe their university grades for their content area to explicitly address the argument that we're having in Australia at the moment, which is, you know, that those who can't teach. And is it because, you know, like, are we ending up with the people who couldn't get a job in science or maths that are going into teaching it?
You started the presentation talking about a lot of regional differences in Australia, and that's the case in the U.S. and even in a smaller country like Germany. And I was wondering how you were using just one university within, like, University of Michigan might have very distinct factors, just to people who self-selected to attend there, and how you saw using other universities in different regions, and what were your future plans for that?
We've got four universities in the United States, actually. It's just that's all we sort of had ready with the longitudinal outcomes. So we've got University of Michigan, Eastern Michigan, Nevada. Is there four?
No,
just four. Okay. Right. So it was easier in Australia because we have two major cities, Sydney and Melbourne, and then we have three universities which are the major teacher providers across those two cities, and they're the three universities in our sample, so that's kind of okay. And then we follow them wherever they go. So some of them go into rural areas, some stay in the city, etc. But yes, it's a problem for elsewhere. But we decided to try and turn that into a plus. Because if we, so within Australia, if we just try and make the generalisation argument within Australia that we're well representing beginning teachers in Australia, then isn't it interesting that our scale's functioning in the same way and that we're getting similar patterns across opportune samples from other settings? But yes, I mean, if anyone wanted to go the representation and generalisation route in one of the different settings, we'd be delighted.
Yeah. I'm interested in your research on typologies, so I'd like to ask how you plan to extend and apply that research. And second part, Helen, you mentioned a moment ago including student grades as an additional factor. Have you considered collecting behavioral data and leading that into your monitoring?
Yes.
I think the answer to the question is yes, we'd love another grant. A very large one.
Yeah.
One of the reasons, I have to say, we were very interested in the class work here because we'd actually like to now... Well, let me back up. No one's followed anyone from beginning, end, and into teaching. Lots of people have followed from the end into teaching. Lots of people have done stuff during teaching, but not followed them. So I think, I mean, we don't know where it's going to end, in a sense, but one of the things that I think we would like to do is to be able to look at, okay, see, people say that they're highly efficacious in these things at the end. Well, let's look at, I mean, if we take, you know, the big German study that was done in the 80s, the constant bathtub effect, okay, their efficacy goes down and then comes back up.
But maybe you're just left with the efficacy.
Maybe you're just left with those who, yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I guess we would really like to do is to take something like class and go into some selected classrooms and see what is actually going on behaviourally. That, in Australian context, may cause us a lot of difficulties in terms of the teacher education. Teacher unions may object to that. We have to handle that fairly carefully, I think. But it's certainly some of the things, I mean, at a methodological level, we'd really like to be able to do. I mean, we'd also like to get the grades of students, but our universities are often unwilling to give you that. So, you know, we're struggling, I think, with some issues that you're raising that are quite important. But we certainly need to look at groups of people. I mean, we're working on this sort of, you know, person environment fit model in a sense as they go into the schooling system, and we'd really like to be able to see what does happen to these people in classrooms. I mean, they may be massively highly efficacious when they leave, and then be able to look at some of the things they're doing and see.
So we are interested in following types as a sort of frame for what happens to these three different types of teachers in their early experiences, and can some of them be sort of turned around? So the cluster two, the highly engaged switchers that were high on everything except plan persistence, that's kind of neat that they were high on leadership aspirations, because they're not actually going to be hanging around long enough to develop a leadership position. But maybe if these types of ambitions for change and stimulation and development can be realised in this group, they might be able to be retained. So it'll be interesting to see how the different types develop. And we're very sensitive to how our data could be used by all of the policy hype that's happening in Australia at the moment. And we just want to be very careful. So, of course, we want to know how grades play into all of this, but we just we're just wanting to think very carefully about what to actually publish.
The work that we're doing here, it could really inform how we design professional development for teachers once they're out in the classroom. If we know typologies to aim at and to fill these.
One of the people has now actually gone to Glasgow from our place. He's in the leadership area, and when we presented this another paper that we've done, he really picked up on the fact that that group, there were 510 people, 46% of whom were going to teaching his level, 26% and 27% of them, which is about 112 or something, 120, were saying, you know, they were high on leadership and high, but not persistence. And Peter was saying, you know, that's a remarkable, and are you sure you've got this right? Because, and when you actually looked at the profile of those people, you could actually make an argument that they're sort of like Generation Y. They've heard about the fact that work has been reconstructed, that workplace agreements have been reconstructed. There's not a lot of loyalty anymore, so they're sort of people who are looking at portfolio building in a sense, and looking at shifting that portfolio to somewhere else. And, you know, maybe if their leadership ambitions could be realised in the context of schools, then they may stay. I mean, but they clearly have a profile which is, it's work satisfaction that they're looking for, or looking for work challenges and personal satisfaction as much as anything. So I think it's interesting. I mean, we were actually taken aback by it, that the percentages were so high. I wouldn't have put, you know, if somebody said, oh, what would you expect that we'd get? I might have said, well, you know, the majority are going to teach, you know, 85% will teach, and then the rest will split. But it didn't work out that way at all, did it? And, which was amazing.
Well, thank you very much for sharing.